the headlines, Iran says decades-long crimes against Palestinians by the apartheid regime of Israel stem from the international community's inaction and indifference. Jordan fully reopens its main border crossing with Syria after a decade and is set to resume flights to its neighboring country next Sunday. And former Australian Prime Minister says his successor deliberately deceived France when he scrapped a submarine deal with Paris in favor of U.S. or British alternatives. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, Iran has slammed the inaction of the international community in dealing with seven decades of Israeli violations of Palestinians' rights. Iran's representative at the 48th regular session of the UN Human Rights Council urged the council to recognize Israel as a racist, apartheid regime. The representative said the regime has committed many instances of mass killing, systematic torture, and arbitrary detention. He said the international community's indifference has enabled the regime to commit the gravest injustice in history. The Iranian official said the support offered by the U.S. has made the regime feel immune from any challenges in the global arena. Iran's deputy foreign minister has called for global nuclear disarmament, saying it's the responsibility of all governments to eliminate the threats of these weapons. Reza Najafi made the remarks in the U.S. city of New York during a United Nations General Assembly meeting on the International Day for the Total Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. The Iranian diplomat said the Islamic Republic strongly rejects the preservation, storage, proliferation, and development of nuclear weapons at global and regional levels. Najafi stressed the implementation of the 1995 UN resolution on the Middle East, which endorses a region free of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. The Iranian diplomat called Israel's nuclear weapons an obstacle to the UN resolution. Najafi said the regime poses a threat to peace and security in the region and beyond. Political analyst Mohsen Saleh says the international community must put an end to the illegal conduct of Israel and the United States in the West Asia region.
The Zionist occupation of Palestine has been overlooking all the international laws and protected by the American hegemony and the Western Union. And I guess they have, from the 50s, 1950s, they have a large amount of this nuclear bombs and overlooked by the nuclear the International Nuclear Agency. And now everybody should know, and everybody knows also, that this Ruge institution protected by the West and the Americans should become in the front of this international community and should be put an end for its project, which threatens not only the Palestinians but also the whole region and all the international peace process, if they are really willing to make peace in the region. But it seems that the international community are still stubborn and not committed to the laws they put in order to put an end to this nuclear proliferation in the region. Now it's about time to put an end for this game of the American, Zio-American interests in going illegally to the end to threaten the life in this region.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has appointed Peyman Jebeli as the new director of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. In a message, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has wished success for Jebeli in his new post and thanked the services of outgoing IRIB director Abdulali Ali Askeri. Jebeli, who holds a PhD in culture and communication, has served in various positions in IRIB. The 55-year-old was appointed deputy director of IRIB World Service in August 2016. He's held other posts in the corporation, including CEO of Press TV and Al Alam News Channels. Following his appointment, Jebeli pledged to focus on promoting new Islamic civilization during his five-year term in office.
Our slogan in this phase is to step in order to realize the new Islamic civilization. This is what the second phase of the Islamic revolution focuses on, meaning that we have to make the borders of our audience beyond the borders of the Iranian audience.
Djebeli said all national capacities would be used, especially the capacities of the young elite. In the new era of IRIB, he also pledged to strengthen the IRIB World Service to better convey the message of the Islamic Republic beyond the country's borders. Jordan has fully reopened its main border crossing with Syria in a step to restore extensive business ties with Damascus. The Nasib Jaber crossing was a transit route for hundreds of trucks a day before the Syria conflict started. In 2011, Jordan's state carrier Royal Jordanian will also resume flights to Syria next Sunday after a decade-long hiatus. Bilateral trade between Amman and Damascus amounted to over $1 billion a year before the start of the war. Jordan was a staunch supporter of militants fighting to topple the Syrian government. Damascus correspondent Muhammad Ali says the full reopening of the Jordan-Syria border crossing is very significant for the two countries economically and socially.
Both trucks carrying goods and also ordinary passengers started crossing border crossing from Syria to Jordan and vice versa. Of course, this is very important for both countries, whether we're speaking socially or economically. Also, we have to point out that this step comes just a couple of days following a high-level ministerial meeting between both officials from both countries, several ministers of service sectors like the economy, water, and agriculture visited Syrian officials visited Jordan and held meetings over there. They agreed on enhancing partnerships in the sectors of energy, water, and agriculture. In the trade and industry fields also, both sides agreed to exchange lists of priority commodities to enhance commercial exchange. They also overviewed the necessary procedures to reopen the Jordanian-Syrian free zone.
Yemeni officials have slammed as illegal a meeting in Iraq's Kurdistan region on normalizing ties with Israel. They also hailed the Iraqi government for decrying the conference. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more from the Yemeni capital.
Yemenis have condemned what the Iraqi government has described as an illegal meeting held in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. The meeting demanded Baghdad join the so-called Abraham Accords and normalize ties with Israel.
We believe in the rights of the Palestinian people to liberate their land, and therefore we will stand against any attempt to normalize relations with Israel. The recent illegal meeting in the Iraqi city of Erbil is completely rejected. It's a desperate attempt after the failure of the so-called deal of the century. Palestine will be liberated and Israelis will be expelled.
Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour slammed the meeting, saying it is an attempt to drag the free people of Iraq to normalize relations with the Israeli regime, adding those who have normalized ties with Israel are part of the Zionist project in the region.
The normalization meeting that was held in Erbil, Iraq, is an attempt to drag the Iraqi people into normalization with the Israeli enemy and for Iraq to become part of the Zionist project, as some Arab rulers did last year. But the conference failed and was rejected by all the free and resistance forces in Iraq because it is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause and the Islamic nation.
The so-called Abraham Accords is a U.S.-led Middle East initiative aimed at establishing diplomatic relations and full normalization between Arab countries and the Israeli regime. This agreement was signed by Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and Sudan, and was welcomed by Israeli officials.
Yemenis have praised the Iraqi government's rejection of normalization of ties with Israel. They say the free people of the world will always support the Palestinian cause until the liberation of the occupied territories. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says his successor deliberately deceived France when he scrapped a mega submarine deal with Paris in favor of U.S. or British alternatives. Turnbull criticized the handling of the switch and accused Scott Morrison of not acting in good faith. He said Morrison's betrayal of France's trust will dog Australia relations with Europe for years, Turnbull's government had approved the submarine deal with France in 2016. Morrison's decision came in the wake of a new strategic alliance between Australia, the United States, and Britain. He said the switch decision was driven by changing dynamics in the Asia-Pacific region. Paris reacted with fury, saying it was kept in the dark until the last moment. France described the cancellation as a stab in the back. The United States says North Korea's missile launches are a threat to the region, but they would not stop Washington from pursuing a diplomatic path forward. The top U.S. envoy made the comment after North Korea announced the test fire of a new developed hypersonic missile on Tuesday. Sung Kim, who also serves as U.S. ambassador to Indonesia, said Pyongyang's measure does not change the U.S. position. Earlier in a speech at the United Nations General Assembly, North Korea announced that its weapons tests were within the country's right to self-defense. Pyongyang wants the U.S. and South Korea to scrap their double standards on weapons programs to start diplomatic talks. Political commentator Greg Simon says North Korea's testing of a newly developed hypersonic missile is for self-preservation and protection.
This so-called maximum pressure of the U.S. to force an unfavorable agreement with the North Koreans is not going to work. And secondly, the idea that they would leave themselves defenseless, such as Iraq, Libya, and other countries, increases the risk of external attack. So that this is also, as I say, a means of self-preservation and protection.
North Korea says it's open to negotiations on a declaration for a formal end to the Korean War as proposed at the United Nations by South Korean President Moon Jae-in. With Pyongyang's positive response to talks, some in South Korea suggest a leadership summit may be possible. Our correspondent Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
At the United Nations this week, North Korea outlined the defensive nature of its nuclear weapons, which has been subject to U.S.-led Security Council sanctions for more than a decade.
We would never violate or endanger the security of the United States, South Korea, and our neighboring countries. We're just building up our national defense in order to defend ourselves and reliably safeguard the security of the DPRK.
Pyongyang also held out hope for a dialogue with the U.S. and South Korea.
I'm convinced that a good prospect will be opened up for U.S.-North Korea relations and inter-Korean relations if the U.S. refrains from threatening the DPRK and gives up its hostile policy.
The remarks from North Korea follow the proposal made by South Korean President Moon Jae-in for a formal declaration to end the Korean War. While the U.S. says it's open to talks without conditions, North Korea remains under biting sanctions over its nuclear program. Analysts suggest a shift in U.S. policy and a mediating influence may bring the parties together.
The U.S. will not offer any specific concessions, such as discontinuing U.S.-South Korea military exercises, demonstrating flexibility over sanctions against North Korea, or even at least concerning humanitarian aid to bring North Korea to the negotiating table. That's where a third party may play an important role.
Both Koreas have engaged in recent missile tests, and the U.S. stations 28,500 troops and deploys advanced weapons in South Korea. Discussion has emerged this week of the possibility of an inter-Korean leadership summit, while an end-of-war declaration is seen by many as a step in reducing tension. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has managed to place peace on the Korean Peninsula back in the conversation. But President Moon's single term in office ends next spring, and conservatives are poised to challenge for the country's top office and would likely implement a hard-line strategy toward Pyongyang. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Thousands of internally displaced Afghans have no access to health care services, water, or enough food. This comes as the U.S. move to freeze Kabul's assets has worsened the economic crisis in Afghanistan. As official figures show, over 3.5 million Afghans have been driven from their homes since the beginning of 2020 and are in need of urgent humanitarian aid.
Some major international humanitarian agencies are warning about the consequences of the economic crisis in Afghanistan due to widespread joblessness, poverty, and U.S. sanctions on the country. Either war or unemployment has forced Hamid and hundreds of other families to flee their homes and get to Kabul in search of a better life. But contrary to their expectations, they are leaving here and this camp in northern Kabul for the internally displaced. They are living dire conditions and deprived of basic services.
We left our village in Baghlan province after the escalation of clashes back in July. Now we are living here while we have no access to our basic needs, such as portable water, electricity, or healthcare services. Hundreds of people here are suffering from malnutrition as well.
Abdullah is another internally displaced man who also lives here with his family members. He says nor the Taliban, neither humanitarian aid agencies have so far met their needs. Therefore, he asks for implementation of a transparent supporting plan for people like himself and the rest of vulnerable Afghans who are suffering from hunger and malnutrition.
Humanitarian aid should be distributed among the neediest families like us. But so far, we have seen that most of those who are in charge of handing out humanitarian assistance are corrupt figures because they usually distribute the aid among their own relatives and friends.
Under such circumstances, the Taliban administration has also called on the international community and humanitarian aid agencies to resume their aid supplies to Afghanistan. This comes as some neighboring countries of Afghanistan, like Iran and Pakistan, have begun sending humanitarian aid to Kabul, a move that is widely welcomed by both the Taliban and ordinary Afghans, especially the internally displaced ones.
A rise in the number of internally displaced people has put pressure on Afghanistan. Moreover, Afghans are already denied access to their assets, as Washington has frozen them under the name of slapping sanctions on the Taliban. However, facts on the ground show that Washington's move has affected the lives of ordinary Afghans, especially internally displaced people, rather than affecting the Taliban. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
February 3rd, 2021. Fatemeh Zahra, peace be upon her, is the leading lady of all the women of the world. At a young age, Fatemeh Zahra, peace be upon her, achieved such a high level of spirituality that according to certain narration, the angels spoke and showed some truth to her. She was called Al-Muhaddatha, which means someone who is with whom the angel speaks. When reading this application for visiting the shrine of Imam Rida alayhi salam, when it comes to sending our greeting to Hazrat Zahra, peace be upon her, she is referred to as Al-Tahira, Al-Muhaddatha, Al-Taqiyya, Al-Naqiyya, Al-Radiyya, Al-Zakiyya. Hazrat Zahra's purity has been expressed using different expressions. Purity of the spirit, purity of the heart, purity of the mind, purity of one's lap, and purity throughout all of life. Well, these are practical expressions and teaches us something. We would try to cleanse and purify ourselves without having a pure inner being. We cannot achieve lofty positions, nor can we get close to the heaven of these great personalities' guardianship. So a purity of one's inner being is achieved through piety and righteousness.
Subhanallah,
Fatemeh Zahra, peace be upon her, was an exalted scholar in knowledge. Fatemeh Zahra, peace be upon her, delivered a sermon in the Medina Mosque after the demise of the Prophet, about which Allama al-Majlisi said, eloquent writers and scholars should sit down and interpret its word and phrases. This is such an insightful and meaningful sermon. Perhaps for an hour, she spoke with the best, most beautiful phrases and the finest, well-selected terminology. In the period after the Prophet, peace be upon him, migration to Medina, Fatemeh Zahra, peace be upon her, was at the beginning of the minimum of age of marriage. At the time, she married Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, and her dowry and wedding gift, perhaps you all know, were very simple and very little. This is how the marriage ceremony of the daughter of the first person in the Islamic world was conducted.
You've done for me through all my years.
light fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Retired Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is the former chief of staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who emerged as a leading critic of the neoconservatives. Neoconservatives are characterized by their support of hawkish foreign policies. In remarks to Mass Peace Action last June, he made some brazen assertions about Israel.
I said the other day Israel would not be a state in 20 years. It'd be gone. It certainly would not be a democracy. It'll be an apartheid state. And the world will just reject it, as they did South Africa. But I'm now saying it probably won't be a state. It'll be gone.
He pointed to the 1946 Joint Chiefs of Staff to a State War Navy Coordinating Committee, noting that then U.S. President Harry Truman was trying at the time to decide whether to recognize Israel in 1947-48 and what to do about U.S. policy. Wilkerson said, Israel is a strategic liability of the first order for the United States, and the chances are very high it would drag Washington's feet into a full-fledged face-off.
Israel is the most likely state in the world to take the United States to Armageddon. And I could paint you all sorts of ways we would do that and the ways we would get there.
The retired general also revealed that during 40 years of military service, he had heard constant advice from everyone not to establish an American military base in the Israeli-occupied territories. He stressed that the United States standing with Israel against half of the world is not a good thing. The Israeli regime, he said, needs to be reined, but that would not happen.
Israel, I think, needs to be reined in, and it needs to be told in no uncertain terms, you will change, and you will change swiftly and effectively, or you can count your sugar daddy gone.
Yeah,
not going to happen. Not going to happen.
In fact, Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel for decades through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes.
Well, I certainly think that that's a possibility. I do agree that it is delegitimizing itself, even in the eyes of many Jews around the world, especially young Jews, which is going to make it hard, of course, for Israel to reproduce itself. And yes, I think it's being considered more and more a worldwide pariah.
Wilkerson has said that the obsession of U.S. neoconservatives, particularly former Vice President Dick Cheney and former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, is to plunge the entire Middle East region into chaos and to keep Israel's enemies at each other's throats so that they could not unite and give Israel trouble, militarily or otherwise. Wilkerson also pointed out that it does not matter for neoconservatives to target Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, or Iran in their pursuit to set the region on fire, as the important thing for them is to protect Israel. However, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The latest sign of this assertion is the U.S. House of Representatives' decision to pass a bill to provide $1 billion of additional funding to replenish Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system, despite the regime's blatant violation of Palestinian human rights.
In recent decades, the United States has increasingly used sanctions as an instrument of foreign policy. There are different types of sanctions, economic or financial restrictions, trade prohibitions, and blocking or seizing assets of individuals, organizations, and countries.
Now, a coalition of North American human rights organizations, named the Sanctions Kill Coalition, has released a report on the impacts of the U.S. sanctions on other countries and their people. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter. The report has also revealed a bitter reality that Western media rarely or never talk about. One finding is that U.S. sanctions are hurting the most vulnerable and driving middle-class citizens into poverty. Also, they have resulted in thousands of deaths and humanitarian exemptions. For instance, U.S. sanctions on the Syrian Central Bank have collapsed the country's currency, sending millions of civilians into grinding poverty. Also, waiving sanctions by the U.S. undermined countries' capacity to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, resulting in loss of lives. The inhumane sanctions caused difficulty for countries like Iran to obtain medical supplies, sanitation equipment, and other necessary goods to slow the virus spread. Therefore, the U.S. contributed to many unnecessary deaths in Iran.
So we've actually known for 100 years, at least a century, what the impact is. The impact is primarily felt by the civilian population, and it is devastating.
The report also says many U.S. sanctions are based on false claims of an emergency and a threat to national security. The 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York. World leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern, including rejecting inhumane sanctions. During his speech at the United Nations General Assembly, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro called for the lifting of sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union on his country.
We ratify our request. Our demand to the United States and the European Union governments lift all the criminal sanctions against the Venezuelan economy, against the Venezuelan society. We say it with the reason and morality that we have, and we say it on behalf of 30 million Venezuelans.
Maduro denounced what he called permanent systematic aggression waged against Venezuela through these restrictions and called for the establishment of a new world free of colonialism and imperialism. Also, Cuban President Díaz-Canel lashed out at the U.S. administration of Joe Biden for intensifying, quote, the cruelest economic blockade ever imposed against any nation.
The U.S. government has not for 1 minute ceased its attacks on Cuba. But at this crucial and challenging moment for all nations, its aggressiveness exceeds all limits. The cruelest and most prolonged economic, commercial, and financial blockade ever applied against any nation has been opportunistically and criminally intensified in the midst of the pandemic.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, the Cuban president said, "The U.S. is extorting sovereign states to act against countries it identifies as adversaries." He said the U.S. presses its allies to build coalitions to overthrow legitimate governments. Western media has failed or maybe wanted to fail to inform the public about the consequences and global condemnation of U.S. sanctions. Most U.S. citizens are unaware of the severe harm being done to millions of residents of countries such as Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Iran.
It's a primary foreign policy tool that the U.S. government uses in order to weaken and decimate countries that it has disputes with. It should be considered a crime against humanity. The kind of sanctions against a country, against a whole people or a whole nation should be considered a crime against humanity because the effects are horrible.
Exacerbating the suffering of civilians in different countries during a severe health crisis such as the coronavirus pandemic is morally corrupt and a clear disregard for basic human rights. This is what U.S. sanctions have done. The U.S. may be quick to deny this, but deep down it wants sanctions to provoke the populations to rise against the government in the hopes of regime change in the respective countries, something it has for the most part failed to achieve.
After days of controversy, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a $1 billion bill
to fund Israel's so-called Iron Dome missile system. American lawmakers approved the bill in a 420-9 vote on Thursday. The push had appeared in a bill on Tuesday aimed at providing emergency funding to the U.S. government to avoid a shutdown, but was later removed without explanation. The removal was attributed to opposition from a small group of Democrats who demand the U.S. support for Israel be based on the regime's human rights record. The exclusion of the provision, however, drew strong reactions from Republicans and pro-Israeli Democrats, with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham calling the move despicable.
The progressive movement in Congress consists of maybe, I don't know, less than 10% of the Congress. So they have very little power, and furthermore, the progressives in Congress don't often use their power. They're intimidated a lot of times into going along with the rest of it. So we can't expect very much from the progressives.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett thanked both parties in the House for their support, adding that those who tried to challenge the U.S. support for Israel got a resounding response. The bill is now heading to the Senate, where it's highly likely to be approved, as American politicians from both political camps have traditionally backed Israel. It's also expected to be signed into law by President Joe Biden, who has already signaled support for the additional aid. Pro-Israel American lawmakers have been pushing for additional funds to Israel to replenish the regime's missile system since the most recent war on Gaza ended in a ceasefire earlier this year. The truce stopped the 11-day conflict in May, the most intense fighting between Palestinian resistance groups in Israel in years. Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing the show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. The sheer scale of the attacks overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome anti-missile system. The war killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children in Gaza and 12 people in Israel. That's a significant number, considering the regime's heavy expenditure on anti-missile systems, while the resistance in the impoverished and besieged Gaza Strip has no means of shooting down Israel's missiles.
From the point of view of justice, there's no reason not for Palestinians not to have an Iron Dome system. But obviously, that's not what Israel wants at all. Israel wants to be able to hit Palestinians, to cause misery and destruction and death to Palestinians, whenever they feel like it.
The move by Washington to increase aid to Israel comes despite calls by some U.S. politicians and activists to cut fundings to pressure the regime into respecting Palestinians' rights. With all that said, the reversal of the move to include the additional aid to Israel in the U.S. government's spending budget suggests that Washington's unwavering support for the regime is beginning to falter, as no U.S. lawmaker would hesitate to approve more funding for Israel a few years ago.
Thousands of Yemenis have taken to the streets to mark the 7th anniversary of the September 21 revolution against the Saudi-backed regime in Sana'a. Participants in the rally chanted slogans against foreign aggression while carrying the country's tricolor flag and pictures of top resistance leaders. They also denounced the criminal complicity of Western powers and the Israeli regime in the Saudi-backed aggression and war-ravaged Yemen. The demonstrators vowed to uphold their revolutionary ideals and not surrender to the foreign powers. They said the popular revolution had thwarted the conspiracy to divide Yemen through resistance to foreign aggression and hegemony.
Yemeni people are working hard to liberate themselves from the tutelage and occupation. It is known to the world that the occupation does not last, and no matter how long it remains, it will eventually depart.
In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed, unpopular regime of Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement on September 21 took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The massively popular protests were against an incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh and directed by the U.S. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, the Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
I think at this present time, the Saudis are willing to keep this thing going. Even if they can't win, they'll keep it going so as to not be pointed at and said they lost. How long they can do this is, I don't know, but I think that's our present situation.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement says the U.S. was in charge of administering his country's internal affairs prior to the popular revolution against former Yemeni President Abd Rabbo Mansur Hadi, better known as the September 21 Revolution. He highlighted that Washington used to conduct Yemen's affairs before the September 21 Revolution, and the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a had the upper hand over the presidential office. The Ansarullah leader went on to say that the U.S. used al-Qaeda terrorists to create division within Yemen and to advance its hegemonic agenda, stressing that Washington also sought to influence Yemen's educational system in favor of the Israeli regime.
The Saudis and the UAE are influenced by the U.S., as is the U.S. influenced by them. They are dependent often on U.S. weapons, of which they are major purchasers, and that makes us dependent on them. But they are not controlled by Washington.
He added that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are just pawns in the hands of the U.S. and are cows being milked by Washington to serve the Tel Aviv regime's interests. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and regional allies, launched the war on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Hadi's government back to power and crushing Ansarullah.
I don't think that the Saudis can win under present circumstances. And I think the support, whatever they got out of Trump, is probably less now, relatively speaking, under Biden. But there's this other factor, and the factor is that the Saudi government and the head of the Saudi government doesn't want to lose face. Now, you and I might be able to accept losing face under certain circumstances, but they don't believe that they ever want to lose face.
The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more. It has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and spread famine and infectious diseases. The Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees, however, have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders, leaving Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This is the teacher. We will tell you the story of the martyrs of the sacred defense of Iran.
مسئله دفاع مقدس علاوه بر این که یک آزمون بزرگی.
The Sacred Defense Era, besides being a great test for the people of Iran, it was also a test for demonstration of talent.
حسین خرازی، همت باکری، بیش از یک مرجع تقلید رهروی می شود.
Martyrs like Hussein Kharrazi, Mahdi Bakri and Ibrahim Hemmat have many followers as our religious maraja have.
I ask the people to support the Vilayat Faqih. The way of our martyrs is the way of truth.
Today's story, the life and character of Shahid Hussein Kharrazi. Dear listeners, one of the famous martyrs of Iran's holy defense against Iraq during the rule of Saddam is Shahid Hussein Kharrazi. Shahid Kharrazi was born in 1957 or 58 into a religious family in the city of Isfahan. When he started going to school, he also participated in religious gatherings and Quran sessions and was the mukabbir of the congregational prayer of his mosque. After obtaining his diploma in 1977 or 78, he went to serve in the military. However, as the Islamic Revolution reached its peak in 1979, Shahid Kharrazi escaped the garrison and joined the ranks of revolutionaries. And now, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei talks about the sacred defense of Iran.
مسئله دفاع مقدس علاوه بر این که یک آزمون بزرگی بود برای ملت ایران، آزمونی هم بود برای بروز استعدادها.
The sacred defense era, besides being a great test for the people of Iran, it was also a test for demonstration of talents, talents of individuals, as well as talents of different areas of the country. In regards to the individual's talents, I believe that there is an important and noteworthy point which is overlooked. That is to say, it is so obvious that it is neglected. It remains unnoticed for being so apparent.
What I'm pointing at is the fact that the sacred defense era becomes an instrument for the hidden talents present within individuals to be discovered in an astonishing way. For example, we notice that a youth from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps enters the battlefield having no familiarity with military affairs. He is not involved. Then, over a period of a year, or a year and a half, or 2 years, he turns into a military strategist. This is an extremely noteworthy point.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Teacher. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, he became a member of the Municipal Defense Committee of Isfahan and played a crucial role in the regional anti-revolutionary struggles, arresting elements of Savak and elements of the Shah's regime, and guarding the vital positions of the city. Due to the competence Shahid Kharrazi demonstrated when defending his city, he was trusted and given the responsibility for managing the committee. He went to Kurdistan when there was a lot of struggle there, and after the city of Sanandaj was freed, Shahid Kharrazi became the commander of the tactical Hamza construction headquarters, holding the position of leading the SWAT team, which was one of the powerful battalions of that time. Shahid Kharrazi had a crucial role in ensuring the security of the other cities of Kurdistan province, such as Saqez, Bane, Marivan, and Sardasht. General Soleimani talks about Shahid Hussein Kharrazi.
من عذرخواهی میکنم از علمامون اگر کلامی گفته میشود و احیاناً
I would like to take apology to say these words in front of our ulama here.
حسین خرازی همت باکری بیش از یک مرجع
But martyrs like Hussein Kharrazi, Mahdi Bakiri and Ibrahim Hemmat have many followers as a religious maraja have. Of course, they are not followed in terms of fiqh or Islamic laws, but they are considered as a source of inspiration for many people in different dimensions.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Teacher. As we said, one of the well-known martyrs of the Iran-Iraq War is Shahid Kharrazi. He was a very brave commander. One of the characteristics of this great martyr was his reliance on Allah and his prudence. He would always make predictions of everything and would make preparations for them. His way of dressing was such that sometimes people wouldn't think Shahid Kharrazi is a commander. He was a courageous individual, and his courage was proven to everyone in the battlefield. He would always keep company with his fellow combatants and would take the right action at the right time. Shahid Kharrazi was very skilled in utilizing different weapons. And now, this is the voice of Shahid Kharrazi.
جنگ بدون تلفات، بدون زخم، بدون شهید اصلا معنا نداره.
War has no meaning without sacrifice, injury or martyrdom. These are inevitable parts of every war. But our war against the enemy is different from the other wars. Every hardship An affliction that we bear during this war is destined for us by Allah, and we as believers count it as a gift from Allah, and we say, we all belong to Allah, and to Him is our final return. Now, if one of us is injured during war, he does not feel the pain if he has a strong faith in Allah and what is destined for him. We as believers have to be strong and show no sign of weakness in our spirit or body.
And now, Sister Zainab reads to us an excerpt of the last will of today's Shaheed.
I ask the people to support the Vilayat-e-Faqih. The way of our martyrs is the way of truth. First, I want them to forgive me and to intercede me on the Day of Judgment, and I ask Allah to help me continue their path. Those who taught us the lesson of sacrifice with their being and their lives, with their jihad, they taught us the lesson of resistance, and with their going, they taught us the lesson of love. I seek forgiveness from Allah. God, I seek refuge from the darkness, tightness and pressure of the grave and the questioning of Nakir and Munkar on the Day of Judgment and Resurrection. Help me, O God, I am heartbroken and distressed. I recognize you and only you as the master of triumph and success.